From multiple wing-dinging locations in Minneapolis or near enough, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk gaming and game development. I'm Ellen Burns-Johnson, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Arthur Croy. I, too, make nice games.
For this week's episode, our topics are fonts and jank. And so if everyone is ready, let's start. Jank.
The way you read jank was great.
I'm excited for
jank. There was a little bit of jank in your voice when you said it. That's beautiful.
I'm getting a clearer understanding now, since I must be channeling jank.
Well, good. I'm glad one of us has. Yeah. I'm nervous and excited for that conversation when we get to it. Well, this is the first roundtable from us of 2021. Welcome to the new year, though we've been in this year for 3 months now.
It's March. It's crazy.
Yeah, I know. It's wild.
This is the 13th month of March.
Yeah, that's kind of how it feels. Like, wait, yep. It's March again? Is it the same March as before?
Yeah, we had cold March, and we had holiday March. Mm-hmm. We had Thanksgiving March, and now it's just March, second March now, I guess.
Yeah,
so it's coming up.
New March.
Well, he's coming up
March,
for us.
March 2.0. March plus. Yeah.
Yes. wild.
So, yeah. It's good to be back doing podcast stuff again. But what else? What have you been doing with your Februaries and stuff other than Robossing? Because we have a whole episode where we talked about that.
Yeah, we're done talking about that forever.
Sure.
Yep. I've actually bought a bunch of random things. Chinese New Year was last month, or I guess for us, it's still this month. This is the last day of February for us, but this will be out in March. Mm-hmm. I get a really significant bonus from work that time. Ooh. And I've been using that bonus to buy random things. I bought a new monitor. I have new headphones that I'm listening to this, us recording this through it now. What else? I bought a whole bunch of other stuff. I can't think of it at the moment. But I got an eye mask for sleeping.
Nice. Oh, you were saying you were going to do that.
Yeah. It's been kind of weird because, like, while I'm sleeping, I sleep on my side, and I think I, like, shove the eye mask into my eye, which is not a very comfortable sleeping environment.
Mixed result.
Yeah. So I'm still working with that, but, like, I'm interested in it, you know, helping me sleep better. Because I have a hard time sleeping in. I think I'm more sensitive to the transition between night and day than most people are. So I figured that this eye mask thing would help me. I don't know that it has yet, because every time I've used it, I've woken up at a time I normally have. It might just be my internal clock just makes me wake up and not the daylight like I thought it was. So
yeah,
it's valuable to have spent $30 to know that.
As someone with the exact opposite problem, but I have no internal chronometer whatsoever. Like, it's interesting to hear you describe what is something I can never have as a problem.
Yeah, like, but then I hear
darn it in my routine. Describing,
right. Well, no, and then I hear you describing, like, sleeping for like 12 hours, and I'm like, wow, that's so amazing. I wish I could do that. If I stay up super late, I just get 5 hours of sleep, and that's just how I have to live in the world.
Mm-hmm.
it's something else. Oh, that's great.
Well, I also bought something to make me feel better in February. Which is, I bought a new MIDI keyboard, which I'd been meaning to do for a little while. I'll put a link to it in the show notes, because I recommend it if someone wants to get into music at a low price, like a high quality little device. When I was younger, I recorded a lot of instruments and had a whole, like, audio setup and a bunch of gear, but I didn't use it a lot because it wasn't like my main thing, and so it didn't get a lot of use. It was just sort of like, because it took a lot to set up, and then when I went to just using a little USB MIDI keyboard for everything, I started writing a lot more music. And I just got an upgraded version of that model. It's like $120. It's really cool. I'll put a link to that. And the reason I did it was because a friend of the show and previous guest, Chell Wong, has a thing that she does every year where she recruits a bunch of people for to write a song in the month of February for it's like a game jam, but for pieces of music. And lots of game composers are part of it, and then releases it as a charity album for Able Gamers. And so I decided to volunteer to submit something this year because I needed kind of an excuse to make some music, and it seemed like a cool, fun cause. And so I did that, and that's that. It is the last day of February, and so it's not out yet. And I think it will be out sometime in March. I might have the details for the show notes, but I'm really pleased with what I ended up with. Which usually when I write music, I do it very quickly, and it's good enough. And I'm like, this one I was able to sit with and spend some more time with, and I had like a bigger concept for it, and I'm pretty happy. It's a new kind of thing for me. Maybe we'll do a clip of it in the show notes for people to listen to, but because it's going on this album, if you want to hear the whole thing, you should buy that album, and we'll try to have those details if they're available when we publish this thing.
Yeah,
Ellen,
cool.
Ellen, did you buy anything?
Did I buy? I'm sure I did. What did I buy? I bought some stuff off ThreadUp. Some online retail therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And bought some books. Bought some fiction books. Sci-fi. Ah. Stephen, I think it's Bruce or Brust. I can't remember how to pronounce it, but he actually lives in St. Paul. He's a Minnesotan author of like sci-fi slash fantasy stuff. So I had one of those moments like I remember there was a book that I found on a shelf. And I remember what it looked like, but I couldn't remember what it was called. And I couldn't remember who had wrote it. And so I Googled it and my Google foo came through and I was able to track it down. So I bought the first like 9 books in the series.
Oh, dang.
Nice. Well, I found a cool online used bookstore. I like buying used things because I don't like generating waste. So like I buy most of my clothes used. I try to buy used books when I can because I like paper. Mm-hmm. I like reading things on paper instead of reading things on a screen. Yeah. But I also don't like, why make new things when there are plenty of good, usable, used things out there? Mm-hmm. So I found a really good deal and got like 10 books for $20 or something like that. It's nice. So I'm pumped.
That's great. And finding the time to read it all is the next challenge.
I'll make the time. It'll get back to what Stephen was saying. You stay up late and then you wake up at the same time. If our next recording session, I'm looking particularly tired, then you know why.
Well, speaking of books, my topic for today was supposed to be, or originally planned to be, a book review. We established that as a format on the show. And I was going to do a book review of a new book from Jason Schreier, who is an investigative reporter. He worked for Kotaku for a long time. He's at Bloomberg now. He wrote a book that I always recommend to people called Blood, Sweat, and Pixels that had a lot of original reporting and talked about the development of games. Great story about Stardew Valley in particular in there is really good. Lots of really great stories. And his follow-up is called Press Reset. And it's about sort of the opposite of that, when things go wrong, when studios close and sort of restarting and rebuilding and how that industry works. And it's less about development and more about the and ground level. So from the developer perspective. Mm-hmm. And because Nice Games Club has been around a little while, we're on a couple of press lists. And so I got an early copy of this book and I've been reading it and I'm really enjoying it. But it doesn't come out till May, I think. Maybe we'll put a link so people can kind of check it out. And so I'm instead of talking about it now, I'm going to wait until a little closer to release. There's no embargo as far as I know, but I figure it'll be more relevant once people are maybe get it in their hands or get it in their hands shortly. But I've been enjoying it. So I'm now that we are on, we can get books early. Maybe we can start doing more regular advanced book reviews on the show. That would be kind of fun.
Ooh.
But my topic for today is not that. I called an audible. I'm going to talk about fonts. Because I love fonts, you guys, so much. I love them so much. So I'm going to talk about them for a little while until you make me stop.
It's related to books.
Yeah, related to books. But it's you know, as a graphic designer, it's of typography is of great interest to me, and I'm sure listeners have probably heard me talk about that from time to time. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the history of like typesetting, and just to give a little bit of a background, because some of it's really fascinating from a technical side. But I also want to talk about how you use typefaces and fonts in your expression, because when we were doing RoBoston, a lot of the materials that we needed to make required a lot of layout, a text layout, and that got me thinking about how you do that to express a notion, not just about like, am I going to use a modern font or an old-fashioned font or something like that? I think that's a pretty basic idea, but also like density on a page and how something flows and like a lot of those things. And what they and the sort of like language that we use and how we interact with fonts and where that where those things come from. Where does that, you know, why do we associate like a clean modern like a Helvetica with both the New York subway and with government services? Like, why do we make that association? Like, and there's a lot of really interesting historical elements. And then as artists, do we leverage those connections in order to express what we want to express, or do we try to form new connections? And what's the task of that? So I want to get into a little bit of that and hear about your guys' thoughts on stuff like that. But I want to talk a little bit about history as this sort of thing, because, you know, typefaces, fonts, I mean, like there's like the Gutenberg Bible and the history of printing. But the first instance really of like a typeset is can be traced back to like those straight letterings on like Roman buildings. The V's instead of U's, that sort of thing.
Oh,
that's kind of the first instance of like a typeset. And a lot of what we think of in terms of like display signage can really be traced back to that notion. And a lot of times you'll watch like a film that like depicts a historical era, and you'll see like old fashioned signs on ye olde choppies or whatever. But really, that up until more of a modern era, the signage was not a very common thing. You know, even hand painted signs were not as common as you might think they would be. Like the old timey versions of a printed poster would be a hand painted poster. The idea of actually displaying type is relatively modern, only the past couple hundred years where that's been more common. But going further back, these Roman buildings that still have these phrases etched on them, that was a part of that culture. And we get a lot of our notions of how authoritative type and authoritative signage works comes right from that, which is really interesting. And that carries into all the work that we do now. And what it also tells you is that like what up until recently, a lot of the way that fonts and typefaces looked come from the tools that were used to create them. So the reason they're V's and not U's is because you could chisel them easier, you know? And it's definitely true of certain affordances that are done to hand lettering. For professional letterers, people who would copy the Bible, you know, the way that letter forms developed had a lot to do with their workflow and the materials they used. And, you know, serifs work a little bit the way they do in printing because of the way that they collect ink as they're printed. The ink pools in a certain way. It makes things more legible. When the bleed happens, it controls how that happens. And we lose a lot of that, but we still have the associations that were formed because of those decisions that were made. And I think that's really interesting when we think about, it's a good analogy, it's a good metaphor for other types of creative choices we make that we think are associated with a certain thing. Like sometimes it's really helpful to like think back as to why that is and not just where it comes from and what that means and what about it is arbitrary and what about it is connected to maybe a thing you're not certain of. It can help you be a little bit more deliberate about the choices you make. And I think fonts are like a really clean way to engage with that concept. So the next thing I want to talk about is the thing that is where it brings me into the fold in terms of my like particular interest in it, which is like 20th century typography and particularly like modernism, like the international typographic style, which is like Helvetica or Gil Sans or those like clean, you know, non-serif or sans serif typefaces. And that comes from a movement that started in the 20s, and it's where Helvetica comes from. It was popularized in the 50s and 60s and associated with modernism, but a lot of it comes from the 20s and those movements that then eventually found their way to the applications where we associate them with. So things like the New York subway system, or you know, or a government, at least in mid-century, like you think of like the FBI building in DC, like it has a very government look, but that's actually a mid-century modernist kind of approach to building buildings. It was a way to replace the classic Roman or Greek column style that was so associated with American government. So we have these sort of multiple identities associated with these movements in architecture and history.
Yeah.
And how they tie together with, in this case, typefaces. The thing that's really interesting to me about this is that the reason the New York subway uses Helvetica is not, that wasn't the choice they made because they decided that's what it was going to be, clean and modern and standardized. That comes from, or was influenced by, the London Underground, which was, a lot of those subway systems were disparate networks, right? A privately run track, and they would have their own types of signage and their own branding. And the London Underground, when it was starting to put all this together, wanted to have specifically against that kind of confusion, wanted to have a standard system, because other cities like New York in particular had lots of, you know, confusing signage and different maps and all that stuff. And so part of that, the simple clean look of that modernist style, evoked that as an ideology. And so they actually commissioned a font called Johnston that is still used by the London Underground today. And that established that look for that kind of system, like that clean modernist style. Whereas like the Paris Metro, its original signage is this ornate Victorian kind of look. And even today, its identity is kind of mixed in. It doesn't have the same kind of modernist look that like New York or London does in those systems. But we associate like subway systems, and certainly I do, because the game I'm making that uses a lot of subway iconography is very tied to that look. And that just comes from these sort of interesting associations. And it makes me think about design as ideology. Like modernism is a sense of like, it's not just that it looks good, it's that it's the way it works. And that informs a lot of how aesthetics pollinate with like usability. And the fonts you choose and like how they're readable. And like, that's a perfect distillation of that. Like the modernism as ideology is also in architecture, and it's also in modern art, and it's in other types of fields where it's a little bit more dogmatic and a little prescriptive. But in terms of typography, it has a lot of utility that's still very useful today, which I find really fascinating.
That's really interesting, because like, there's like an aspect of world building almost what you're describing.
That's exactly right.
From these fonts that I never would have even thought about. And like, I think that like, man, even the fonts can change. I know that like the fonts can change how the a player perceives the game, but like even that the fonts can change how the player perceives the stories and the narratives and the world on its own is, that's wild. Yeah. Right? Like, the heck?
You know, I think all the time, like, how many RPGs have you seen with like detailed, ornate, artistic style? A lot of like JRPGs are sort of influenced by like a European Victorianism. It's influenced a lot of that aesthetics. And yet the typefaces will be like, you know, the numbers flying off enemies or whatever will be completely don't match with that at all. But that disassociation between those two things is now part of that style in a really interesting way.
And
a lot of that comes from like how you could render fonts on an 8-bit machine, and then that became associated with that genre. But then as the aesthetics of the character design evolved and moved forward, it still held on to a lot of those things. So I always find it's interesting when you look at a video game genre you're not very familiar with, and look for its like touchstones in its different aesthetic choices. A lot of time, and fonts come into that as well. And a lot of it will confuse you if you don't come up and experience those the way where you see the lineage, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, you're talking about this initially, and like the modernism or the modernist philosophy behind font choices. Mm-hmm. A few different games came to mind, and one of them was I played it on mobile. I think it's also on Steam, but it's called Mini Metro. I'm sure you've played it.
I have opinions on that game.
Yes, you do, I'm sure. But I'm only bringing it up for the fonts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it did see, it did really like capture, I think they really tried to capture not just the aesthetic, like the font choices mm-hmm. of familiar like Metro systems, but also just like the way that they use the lines and everything like that.
Yeah.
And a couple other games that came to mind, not because they made necessarily similar choices, but the fonts were impactful. Night in the Woods, like mm-hmm. the way that the characters, I mean, so much of the story is prime in that game, right? And so much of the story is conveyed via dialogue.
Yeah.
And the like the letters that appear in the dialogue bubbles are different colors and they're a little wiggly. They move a little bit and
yeah.
they're like approachable and personal and they don't feel like perfectly, they don't feel chiseled. They feel scribbled.
Yes.
It makes it very like relatable. And then one other game that I always like the font. I just like the way that the UI works and the font is a big part of that. Destiny. I just yeah. really like how they work. You know, it's not,
yeah.
yes, they look fine, but I like how they work. And that's kind of,
yeah.
that's what reminded me of that game was what you're talking about in terms of it has to not just look good. It also has to work.
Destiny is an interesting example because it is, its aesthetics and its character design is really mm-hmm. ornate. And part of that is that's a game design choice too, because of how players interact with that game. Is mm-hmm. A lot of individuality needs to be expressed, and so clean, simple lines is not good for character design in that game. And so they formed a lot around expression and that ornate aesthetic, which is as a sci-fi thing is interesting. But then yeah, their typography is very airy, mm-hmm. right? And very clean and has space. And their layouts mm-hmm. are really interesting. And the combination of those two things says something about the story they tell. I don't like Destiny that much, but I think that's a really good creative use of existing aesthetics in a way that it seems like it shouldn't work if you tell someone that's how it works. But like it does feel like a whole piece. And I really mm-hmm. like that about it.
Yeah, and now that I'm thinking about it, like, I guess this isn't exactly related. It's related to games, but not quite that. But like, I read mm-hmm. a lot of web comics, and yeah. one of the web comics that I read, like, they were originally comics, and then they've been posted as like free web comics. I guess that's why I'm reading them now. But what's interesting is like the author will go into detail on why he made like some of the font choices and like how he did all like the bubble line of the bubble tails and things like that. There's like a mm-hmm. whole thing that comic yeah. book creators like, you know, go in and think about and stuff like that. And I didn't really think about this before, but like a lot of the comic books that I read have different fonts and like different characters will speak with different fonts and those yes. fonts will give you an impression on how this character is speaking. And it's not just like this character is speaking in all caps, so they're yelling at you. It's yeah. like, you know, it's like some of the fonts are like, I guess like you were like Ellen, how you were describing Night in the Woods. Like some of them feel like they're sketched, mm-hmm. or like, and but like with some other web comics, the lines are clean and things like that.
Yeah.
One of the comics I read has robots in it, and like the robots will. Be in a very you'd see it on Visual Studio Code or something, this kind of font, you know. uh-huh. And it's like that, yeah, like that is it adds some character to your game mm-hmm. in a way that I appreciate it, but I didn't yeah. like really 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 think about very hard. Like I know that I'm doing that in Rhythm Rumble, like we have a few different fonts and stuff, and a lot of the fonts are like I don't know how I would describe the fonts, but they're like futuristic-y looking because sure. a lot of the aesthetics that we picked for the game originally were kind of based off of EDM sort of stuff mm-hmm. and so it was supposed to feel a little bit more futuristic-y, but like we've since added a bunch more musical genres and things like that, but we generally speaking we still use those fonts and so like the game still kind of has a more techno vibe, I think, as a result of
yeah that. Which is interesting because Rhythm Rumble does feel like a game that would be really well suited towards using that language mm-hmm. to differentiate between characters, because those touchtones are so specific because of the right. different genres of music that game represents.
Yeah.
You know, finding a perfect pairing is, you know, you have like I mean, the metal won't be that hard, you know?
Right.
But, you know, your example about web comics, one of the more famous examples of this kind of technique is like in like Marvel comics, where it's standard comic lettering is all caps. And I always found that really interesting, at least in Marvel anyway, is interesting because it means that like expressing an all caps sentiment needs to use a different language, like boldface or outlined or things like that. Yeah. And like a character like Thor speaks in kind of a more scripty kind of face. And that's been true, I think, since the character was introduced. And it kind of, it implies an accent, right? Like in a way. And one of the things like the when Marvel relaunched its line in 2000-ish or whatever, their ultimate line, which is like rebooting all their comics, but leaving their old comics to keep publishing. Those characters all spoke with a sentence case, so with lowercase letters where necessary, and they all their comics worked that way. And then later, when they'd have crossover between those two universes, they would remain the people from that universe would speak with the same sentence case, where the people from the original Marvel universe would speak in all caps. Oh. And so that was a clue to the reader where that character came from. You know, you could tell a story about someone in the wrong universe, and that would be a clue, you know, like the first time they speak or something. There's lots of mechanical uses for these kinds of things that can be a little winky. But a lot of times they're just used like the way you're describing those webcomics to sort of let you hear the voice in a way. And that only works because you have this association. So the longest time, anything technical, like in the 70s and 80s, and even into the 90s, something that was supposed to be futuristic looked like the letters that would be on the bottom of a check, right? That type of font. And the reason is because the reason those letters look that way is so that computers could read them off a printed page for optical character recognition. They're not, and yet for the longest time, they were used to show computery things like on a computer screen or in a title sequence. But the reason that font looks like that way is because that's to be printed on paper. But the connection is still drawn because we associate it with technology. But you couldn't get away with that now because we don't treat that. That seems old fashioned to us in a sense.
Yeah.
Now, we only see that font on old things, and so it wouldn't make sense anymore for a technical a milieu, right?
Unless, I've seen a few things where it's like it's a cyberpunk story, so it's futuristic, but it's told using like retro aesthetics.
Yes.
And that's a fun mashup.
Our history is rich enough now that we can do that kind of thing. We can tell an old fashioned futuristic story or the future as if what the 80s thought the future was like, you know.
Exactly.
You see tube televisions used for that purpose, right?
Right.
Where you'll see something that is meant to be retro futuristic and you'll see tube TVs. And this is essentially steampunk was the first time we were able to do this as a culture. But now we have more things now because we've been imagining the future for long enough, and those things have been outdated more than once, that we can now mix together these things in a way that gives us more chances to tell interesting, kind of weird perspective stories and have those little signposts that do that, you know?
Yeah. Cool.
All right. I want to talk about computer fonts real quick before we wrap this topic up, because I think this is super interesting. And it also... about just how these things work on your machine, right? Because as a developer, I think I want to keep this topic to talking about the sort of like artistic properties of this, but there, some of that does interact with how you work with these things. And computer fonts originally were made for printers, like vector fonts. You had like dot matrix printers that could print characters with like a crude pixel grid on a piece of paper, and that was interesting. But prior to that, when you printed something from a computer, it used an automatic typewriter. You know, you had a little typewriter ball would print it onto a page, even though the computer told it what to say. So you didn't have any options. So it was a big deal when you could have printers that could print, vector fonts at any size. And so you would install the font on your printer. And that limited like the types of fonts you had because you license them individually in a way that you don't really these days. It's much more, even if you're a designer, you tend to kind of work with what you got. And occasionally you'll get something because there are a lot of options, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're working in like commercial print or you're working in other industries, you do tend to license fonts more often. But it used to be you had to license them. And so they'd be on the printer you bought, and then you can get packs on top of it. But as is the case today, Adobe is the company that led the way on this through a format called PostScript. And this is actually a Turing-complete programming language, weirdly, but it'll describe the vector shapes of a font, and then the printer will then print it at any size. And the companies that have been involved in this from the early desktop publishing all the way to today are Adobe, Microsoft, and Apple. Those are the three companies that have been consistently making innovations throughout the history of it. And so Adobe invented this kind of system. But PostScript was not very good for display. So Apple came up with a way to put get PostScript fonts onto a display. Microsoft came up with a way. Adobe came up with a way. None of those worked. None of them like became the thing. But eventually it standardized. Microsoft and Apple together in the late 80s co-developed TrueType. So you'll see TTF as a font format. That's TrueType. And that's one of the earliest collaborations between Microsoft and Apple. And it was a competitor to PostScript. But as is often the case, even though it was better and it was also usable for display, there just weren't enough fonts in it. And so it wasn't until the next decade in the 90s when Microsoft and Adobe combined those two formats into OpenType. So you'll see OTF is the current format. That was in the mid 90s, and that is now a standard. It's an open source standard, and all the big tech companies will then contribute to it. And so things like variable type fonts or like ligatures and hinting and all the things that modern fonts have, they get added to the standard over time. So it's an interesting case of like how recent the history of this is and how completely like there hasn't been a lot of competition. It's these three companies pawing at the same idea. And then and then agreeing on it eventually, which is sort of interesting. And a lot of that ultimately is influenced even more. So PostScript turned into PDFs. So a PDF uses the exact same technology. An Adobe Illustrator file, which is the standard for vector art across the whole world, that comes from this technology. And so it is how we expressed these things at different sizes. And so I find that super fascinating that like a lot of these things like get used for other things. And that's one of the things that's interesting about typefaces, that they are a technical expression of an artistic idea. And it's not just in their expression, but in the technology the over time used to create it. So just like with the signage on a Roman building, like the way that those letter forms looked were dependent on the tools that made them. A lot of font technology works the way it does for that reason. Variable fonts, where the user can change how thick or thin they are, is a newer standard for OpenType. But the workflow for artists is not very established. And there's something about light, regular, and bold, like categories of font weight that makes sense to a user. And so variable fonts still have had a hard time getting any kind of traction amongst users. And so you find a lot of times these technologies will interact with how people, the language of art that people have. Like if you have a font that can change thickness down to the minuscule amount, what value is that to you? But is the only reason it doesn't seem that valuable is because we don't have a history of creating things that way. Mm-hmm. You know, like what if how thick something was coordinated with how loud it sounded when you said it? But that's not really how it works. Very heavy, heavy weighted bold fonts used as display on like a magazine print ad or the header of a website, they don't feel like someone's yelling. It's not the language you use for that. But in a comic book word balloon, they would. Right. So I find that like the language of it is relatively limited, but its applications are so vast. Mm-hmm. And the technologies that we have to express that are still being developed, even though it's a relatively simple system ultimately, you know?
Well, it's one of those things where if you have a simple rule set, but a wide possibility of applications, like, I mean, there are 12 notes in the Western, like in the music scale, right?
Yeah.
Still making
new
music.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and it kind of reminds me of that from a philosophical perspective. But I'm gonna look at signs differently from now on, and probably games too.
That's a good analogy with music, because microtonal music has been around for a long, long time, but it has not taken, it still is an exception to what we normally do, because the language, the momentum, the language of those 12 notes is so strong. Mm-hmm. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This is really cool. My mind is a little bit blown, I think, at this moment. It's kind of weird for me to think about like fonts. Or it's kind of weird to me that like I recognize that fonts exist, but like it's weird to think about fonts in this way that like I don't know. My mind's still blown. I can't fully process my words.
You know, I want to revisit this topic with Adia, because you know, you see some really interesting font usage with text-based games, like, you know, Built with Twine or Ink. I'm curious how she thinks about those decisions, the font choice and the impact on gameplay when the font choice makes up a much bigger portion of the creative experience, like the experience for the player. So put a pin in that.
I will tell you, one of the interesting things about being someone who is obsessed with fonts, and when I do write something that's going to be displayed somewhere, that it's not just its text, a lot of times the letter forms I choose and the layout that I have really influence the words that I pick to say, in a way that I think is not really talked about enough.
Interesting.
And I think that's something that would be worth talking to Adia about, and to a lot of people about, like how the medium influences the message, right? And how sometimes it's subconscious. We don't always recognize that that's the case. But yeah, we should be revisiting this topic for 100 reasons. and certainly things like, you know, how do you get fonts in your game? How do you license fonts? Some of the technical stuff that we didn't have time for this time. But like, you know, raster fonts and just all sorts of, and the tools available to us and the tools we don't have. And maybe that's the reason why we don't have a wide enough expression that we could. And I don't know. It's all super fascinating.
Yeah.
So thank you for letting me yammer on for a little bit about it.
It was worth it. Hey listeners, it's been a while. How you doing? I didn't hear your answers just then because this is a podcast. You're listening to me, but I can't listen to you. But, you know, you can have a conversation with a friend if they were to listen to the podcast. So you can send it to somebody you know, somebody you care about, somebody who you cherish and want to share the nice Games Club love with. And really, the show gets a lot better if we have more listeners, because we get more feedback, we get a better understanding of what our audience wants. We can provide that content for you, and you can form your own Nice Games Club with this content. So you can send it to a friend through email, on Discord, on Twitter, on Facebook, any of the social media things. We'd really appreciate it, because you know, the more of us listening to us, the better we get. Yep, that's a phrase.
Strong showing, Stephen.
Yeah.
I mean, listener, there's lots of reasons to share the show, but if that heartfelt messaging from Stephen just now didn't convince you, I mean, I don't even know if we want you to listen to the show anymore.
Dang.
Just I was going to go with the tack, like, you know some font nerds. I know you do. So, like, have them, bring them into Mark's circle, and they can have a stronger font geekdom. Yeah. And I think Steven's converted as a font geek now.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's a good angle. If there's anything you've heard on this show that has, like, really, you know, piqued your interest, or, like, I want to, and if you ever looked up anything as a result, hearing about the show, imagine sharing that with someone else. Not just that topic, but that opportunity to learn more about stuff.
That's the whole show, really. Learn more about stuff.
Yes. That's our new tagline.
We'll put that on a sign.
With a big font.
Yeah. It has been a while since we've done one of these, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can tell. Oof.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Y'all turned it around, though. Thank you.
Well, speaking of...
Yeah, speaking of janky call to action. My topic is jank. What a word this... Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is pretty good. There's a little bit of jank in the recording. Just a little. Just because, yeah. You know, it's been
and
a little bit.
And Steven is here to convince you that that's a good thing.
Yes! Dang it, I'm not doing a good job.
Well, that's exactly what you were going for.
Yeah, that's kind of true, too. okay, so what is jank? We here at Nice Games Club are going to go on a journey because I have not been able to define what this property jank is yet. The idea of jank comes from, you know, like janky, something that is, you know, not well produced. It's a little messy, you know?
Rough edges. Mm-hmm.
It's got screw loose.
Yeah, yeah, it's got screw loose and things like that. And so the reason why I brought this up is because I was playing Balan Wonderland, the demo of this game that came out. I think it's by the by some of the creators who worked on Sonic games in the past. And it was kind of funny, like the whole story. My brother sent me, because I saw the trailer or something, I was like, oh, I'm kind of interested in this game. My brother watches this group of people or whatever, and they like play through this demo, and they had a whole conversation about how terrible the game was and all this stuff. My brother sent it to me, and I watched this thing, and I was like, huh, I'm curious about this. And Charles was like, no. Charles was like, what's wrong with you? So I downloaded the demo and immediately played him. I tagged it. I tagged my brother, and I was like, hey, I'm playing this game. You better watch it. And as I was playing, I was like, oh, this game's pretty cool. And my brother was not surprised at all. because, and the reason he said it is because because the game was a little janky. And then I was like, what? I immediately agreed with him because sometimes I'm into some games that are just like weird or not quite right or something.
Yeah.
And so like, I immediately agreed with him, but then I had a hard time understanding or trying to express what a game with jank has in it.
Right. As a virtue.
Yeah. As a virtue. Yes. One that mm-hmm. like where it works for it. So like, I think when I use the term jank, I am not talking about games like Skyrim, where, you know, there was that bug in the beginning where, like, if you got hit with the giant's club or whatever, you went skyrocketing into the air. That's funny, but it's like a... but it's not...
YouTube clip.
Yeah, we got to find that. That's a good point. That's funny, but that's not really... that's like glitchy, and mm-hmm. it's not even an exploit. It's like an unintended... I don't know. It's like an unintended, like, funny game glitch thing. That's not quite what I'm talking about. I'm kind of talking about games that, like, the game design itself is a little janky.
Yeah.
Not the game itself.
Oh, that's actually interesting. We've talked about mm-hmm. this a little bit leading up because you've been asking us, like, I need to get my thesis of jank in order so we can get this on the show.
Right.
Jank manifesto.
Yeah. Yes. And either I wasn't listening or I hadn't heard it yet. You say that it's a lot of it is about the design, not necessarily like the feel, which is how most people associate jank with, right?
Yeah, exactly. So like that's and well, I mean, you will get a feeling of this. I don't know. It's like a property. Okay. I'm going to back up. Maybe it'll help if we go over some examples.
Mm-hmm. I think so. Uh-huh.
If either of you two have examples that come to mind, what all of this mess that I'm throwing at you that I don't know makes sense or not, please speak up. Yeah. So, okay, I played Balan Wonderland. The way that this game works, it's a 3D platformer. It's kind of like, it's a little bit like Spyro. Mm-hmm. I was playing it with, yeah, some friends, and somebody brought it up that it was like Spyro. But you kind of, you know, you just run around. The only two actions you can really do in the game is run and jump. And literally all of the face buttons and the triggers on the controller do jump. Like, that is literally the only action you have. I found that's
an interesting design choice. I wonder how intentional that is.
I thought the same thing. And my brother was looking at me when I was like, oh, this is interesting. He was like, what is wrong with you? So that's part of the reason why I wanted to play it. But like, what I think was interesting for me about it is that what happens is like, you pick up costumes, and that costume manipulates your jump, so that you do different things. Like, there's a jump. You get a costume where, like, when you jump, you do like a Crash Bandicoot spin is at the same time, and so you can like break through some blocks and stuff like that.
But it's always that one button.
Yeah. It's always. But the only thing you can still do is jump. So like, your spin is always, or your spin is combined with the jump.
Right. You can't not do it.
Exactly. Yeah. And then there's another costume where when you're holding any of these jump buttons, you like stretch up so you can grab collectibles while you're, you know, stretched up like that. Mm-hmm. And so like, I think for me, the reason why I was interested in this game in particular is because I was really curious to see what kind of things they could do with like these different costumes and stuff, and like how the level design and the game design would work to, you know, make an interesting game.
Yeah. Well, a little bit of it sounds like Mario Odyssey, where there's these little subsections where you get a suit possess one of the creatures, and then you deal with that level with the language of that. And a lot of it is the buttons are the same or whatever.
It is kind of like that. I did misspeak a little bit in that, like, there is the option to switch costumes, which is a button. So that is third action. Yeah, so I lied.
So it's kind of Mega Man then, a little bit.
Yeah. Additionally, what else was like really weird about this game is that, like, as you're running around in this world, like, the world kind of, like, bends. It looks like, okay, so, you know, like, if you were a huge being and you were on the globe, you could see the globe bending.
Right. It's like a subtle Animal Crossing effect.
Kind of. It's like when you're on this platform and the area around you is flat, but, like, all the areas, like, after a certain distance away from you, bend as though you were, like, in an Animal Crossing effect sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that to be super weird, but also interesting. And so I kept, that was also part of the reason why I kept playing. And then additionally, some of the, like, as you're running around in this thing, like, some characters would just, like, be, like, dancing for no reason.
Yeah.
I don't know. They would just be doing some dancing. And as you approach, like, if you get close to them, they just, like, disappear.
I can relate to that.
Yeah,
that's what I do when I'm dancing and some person comes up to me. I'm out of there.
Fair enough. They just like fade from existence. If you walk away from them, they come back, like fade back into existence and do their dancing thing. I don't know. It was just really weird, a little trippy. I don't know.
I'm looking at this trailer now. And yeah. Okay, two thoughts. One is it reminded me immediately of Nights into Dreams.
Yeah, that was my,
which is a game I really liked as a kid, but as I got older and wiser, I realized was an aesthetic mess.
Yeah.
that's what I'm seeing here.
Yep.
But there's, I think what I'm seeing in it, and this is the trailer, right? And so this is their best foot forward, but I'm seeing a lot of choices being made, but not a lot of direction in its styling and look and like, and so I wonder how that must extend to the design as well.
Yeah. Okay. That kind of sounds like what I'm talking about. Yes. Ellen.
I'm going to put on my Ellen cape here and start drilling down into what Jank really is. We're going to get to the crux of Jank.
Evildoers beware, Ellen and the cape.
I'm leaning in. I'm leaning into the microphone here.
You need to see the stance that Ellen is you know, posing right now. It's get ready.
I'm a little scared.
If I were a lawyer, which I am not, this is the stance I would use when I'm cross-examining the witness.
Yeah, yeah.
If I were a lawyer and I were dressed like I am right now, there's a reason I'm not a lawyer. Okay. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm late. I just came from fixing my motorcycle, but...
I'm the bad girl of video game debates.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I get the job done. So the way that you're talking about Cenk to me, Stephen, feels like there's like an element of rough-edgedness, but it's delightful and therefore was either achieved accidentally or left in on purpose.
Yes.
So like the intent behind the roughness doesn't matter. What matters is that there's a little bit of like a rough edge to some elements of the design, and that roughness itself is an element of joy in the game.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I started.
Yeah, okay. Yep.
All right. I'm glad that resonates with you because I want to run a couple of examples by you and some counterexamples because counterexamples are a great way to test the definition.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Okay. So you said glitches aren't the same thing as jank, bugs aren't the same thing as jank.
Yeah.
And that made me think about like Goat Simulator.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. That to me, that feels like a game where there's some jank. Like there's some weird stuff that happens with the physics in that game.
Yeah.
And it adds to the experience in a positive way.
Yep. That's definitely... See, that's really fascinating, too, because I definitely don't like Goat Simulator. But, I can't not describe it as janky. It's definitely intentionally janky.
I think one of the charms of an experience like that, and something that I think... It's achieved through nonsense that I think could better be achieved through elegance, which is... If I'm invested in how this game works, if I'm wanting to do well, and I want to jump from this platform to that platform, but I can't really predict like how it will go, I am freed from the obligation to care how it goes, right? Like I'm no longer invested in the outcome because I don't have full control over it, and so that allows me to care about other things. Like how interesting it looks or how relaxing it is for me. And I'm less invested in like, did I make that jump or not? So that's the case where something like Goat Simulator like leans into that sort of thing. I don't know if that works for the examples you're talking about, though.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point.
Let me give a couple more.
Yes. Continue.
Because I think if jank is going to work, as a design philosophy.
Yeah, because I'm legitimately considering writing a talk on jank. I'm like not even joking.
I think you could. But I think to get there, it's gotta cut across genres, right? Like I think it can. So here let me list a couple more examples of games I think have jank, and then a couple examples that don't have jank.
Yes.
So another example of a game that I think has jank is Humans Fall Flat. I don't know if you guys have played that one.
I have played that game.
Does it have jank? He's thinking. This is what thinking sounds like.
I am thinking. Well, okay, so the games you're describing are like weird physics jokey simulator things, right?
Well, there's two examples. I have a third.
Okay, all right, that's fair. But the two you did describe are that. I'm having a hard time agreeing with Human Fall Flat being janky. Because actually, like, a lot of the mechanics of the game work together, even if everything, like, you're human or whatever, like flops around and stuff and looks silly while they're moving, but everything you're doing, like, actually works, like, as a physical property sort of thing, as opposed to, like, what's that one wrestling game that I can't stand? It's got the same kind of physics thing. I can't think of what the name of it
is. Mean Gang Beasts?
Yes, Gang Beasts, that game. I don't like it.
I was like, I was actually thinking about that before when you said wrestling. It didn't come to me. And I'm like, oh, right. One of the levels is a wrestling ring.
Yeah, that's why I thought that. Whereas like with Gang Beasts, like the physics, I feel like I think they probably all like physically make a lot of sense and stuff, but I think it's at the detriment of the game.
It's all intentional, right?
Yeah. It's intentional, right. In Gang Beasts and Human Fall Flat, yeah.
when you combine two game mechanics, you get a third game mechanic, right?
Yeah.
Like you get, and but you didn't design that game mechanic. It's the result of the two you put into the pot. So maybe the difference is that with something like Gang Beasts or Humans Fall Flat is that all of it is intentional and considered. Whereas in the one you were citing, it's maybe that's what you're feeling is that like this is a thing, but it doesn't seem like it was that way on purpose.
Or it was done on purpose, but like in a way that doesn't make sense. I don't know.
Or doesn't feel like it makes sense. Like maybe it's independent of the truth of the matter, but how it feels as you play, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, Ellen, you haven't. Oh, go
I
ahead.
I still think we're making progress.
Ellen's going to crack this.
we're going to get to the bottom of this. Yeah, we're going to get to the bottom of Jank.
We're going
to
do it.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I'm glad that I'm coming up with examples that are challenging you one way or the other, because that's how we circle around. You know, that's how we tighten the spiral. It's interesting. I was thinking about when I was trying to think of examples, I also tried to think of like a counterexample that was somewhat similar. And Humans Fall Flat is weird because it's like a cooperative puzzle. It's a cooperative puzzle solving game, and there are lots of single player puzzle solving games. So the one that immediately came to mind as a game that doesn't have any jank, that's a puzzle game, is Inside.
Oh, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no I jank. Would not call that janky.
Mm-hmm. No, there's no jank in that game.
No, there's no jank. Well, and that's, I think there's something there. I think, Mark, you were right, too. Like, I think that the intentionality of it, I think it's like a lack of intentionality.
Right.
That is the property of jank.
Inside is a painting that you interact with. Right. It's so specific. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Everything is by design. Yeah. There's very little emergent gameplay. There's no emergence gameplay in Inside. Yeah. And so that and so it is immune to jank in the sense that you're describing it anyway.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's probably some physics wiggles here and there that are odd, but that's not what we're talking about.
I don't think I also don't think that emergent gameplay is necessarily jank. Either.
But it's the playground in which jank can grow or like flourish. And
it's the soil where the seed of jank may sprout.
Yeah, exactly.
I very much appreciate y'all playing around with me.
Okay, I have one last example and an appropriate counterexample, which I think might. Well, gosh, I'm talking it up, so I really hope it's impactful to our conversation.
I hope so too.
That's how she does her closing argument. She's like, I might not convince you, but I
will.
Gives the best closing argument just to set your expectations and then wow you.
Yeah.
I don't need to convince you, Stephen. You need to convince yourself.
You're right.
She knows it's true, but.
Stephen just ran off. I don't know where he went. Okay. The last two games I have are both games where you're working with a team to accomplish a goal.
Yep.
And the non-janky version, this is just me tossing out ideas so that you can shoot them down in the endeavor of getting closer to the definition of jank.
Right.
Overcooked. I don't think that has as much jank or may even not be janky at all. It might not be janky at all, especially compared to Lovers in a Dangerous Space-Time. And Lovers in a Dangerous Space-Time to me is a game that has some of those rough edges, whether they were in there purposefully or not. It's got some of those rough edges, like your spaceship bumps into stuff and everyone's yelling, but it's like so joyful and hilarious that it's like not, it definitely feeds into the game being delightful. Overcooked, there's deliberate difficulty in that game.
Yeah.
But I don't think there's that sense of jank. It actually feels much more tightly tuned, but it's weird because people get angry playing Overcooked. Yeah, I have seen it over and over and over again.
They definitely do.
And even though Lovers in a Dangerous Space-Time isn't as tight, like the environments aren't as tightly tuned, I've never seen anyone get angry playing that game.
That is a really interesting comparison because mechanically they're nearly identical. Every individual character physically move around a shared space at different stations and are and tasked with, I mean, in Overcooked, it's more like you're operating a machine that has a set of instructions, right? Build, make these burgers. Mm-hmm. Whereas Lovers in Dangerous Space Time, you do also make decisions together about like where to go and what. So there's more space for discussion. Whereas in Overcooked, it's do this or you suck at it. Like,
yeah.
So I wonder. So that's a difference. But I, the way you describe the feeling of it, I think you're dead on. Like, Lovers and Dangerous, bumping into something doesn't feel like a mistake the way bumping into something in Overcooked feels like a mistake on the part of the player.
I definitely agree that Overcooked, I would argue, does not have Jank. I'm having a hard time agreeing with Lovers in a Dangerous Space-Time. I can see it having some jank.
Mm-hmm.
I see your point in it having some jank. Whatever that property is. I guess I wouldn't call it super janky, but I think it has some jank in it. I think that a little bit anyways. I think that's fair.
Just a pinch.
Yeah, a pinch. They added the special sauce, you know.
Yeah.
So I'll list another example of a game that I think has jank, because I feel like this game is like the epitome of jank almost.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not. I don't know. I might be talking up too much. Anyways, there's this game on Xbox 360 called Bullet Witch that I played. You're a witch who has a giant gun and shoots things with it, but also can cast spells.
Not Bayonetta.
It's not Bayonetta.
Okay.
No, Bayonetta is a good game. Bullet Witch is not.
Uh-oh.
That being said, I did enjoy that game.
I'm looking at some screenshots of this thing.
It's not a good game. But like...
It's got some real emo energy.
But I still really enjoyed that game when I was playing it.
Yeah.
Even though there were a lot of parts that frustrated me too, because like there were a lot of things you could tell like they didn't finish and stuff. Like a lot of the spaces are barren, but you're like, and it takes you a long time to walk through these spaces and not shoot anything. And it's like, why do I even have this gun? but like when you're actually doing the fights and stuff, and like you could like conjure up a wall so you have cover, and then like you can also like throw out a rose and it would shoot out spikes in the ground and things like that. It has a lot of jank.
Okay, how about this as a this defining it in the way I'm about to might allow you to exclude Lovers in a Dangerous Space-Time.
Okay,
even though Ellen and I both disagree with you.
That's fair.
What if this definition is like a it requires unfinished ideas. So I'm looking at some gameplay of Bullet Witch and seeing what's like what it has and what might be what you're describing is like these empty spaces and things it's missing, but the mechanics are basically there. Maybe that's the idea that like it's an unfinished idea. And so it's got everything you need to have fun, but not everything that it needs to be complete. And so that's fine, but it's just not all the way there. Whereas Lovers in a Dangerous Space-Time, like I really like Ellen's definition of it as a janky game in terms of how it feels, but that is definitely a complete idea. That game is, you know, there's nothing missing from that game.
Yeah. Yes, I agree with that. I feel like there is a property of unfinishedness that is required in order for it to, for me, feel janky.
Yeah. And that ties it back to other definitions of jank, which is about like bugs and glitches. That's the shared definition between those two concepts.
So can I offer an analogy?
Sure. Yes.
So in the definition of jank that I put forward either, now we have competing definitions of jank, competing theories of jank. In Ellen's theory of jank, there's like rough edges, and whether they were intentionally rough or they were forgotten, like someone forgot to finish them, they're there and they're a positive impact on the experience of the game. So for the analogy is like you buy some pre-ripped jeans, you know, like there are holes in the jeans and there's some, or like they don't have a seam at the bottom, but that seam was maybe left unfinished intentionally. It's part of the whole experience of the jeans.
Yeah.
That has intentionality.
Or it doesn't matter. In the Ellen theory of jank, the intentionality doesn't matter. It can be, they said, we forgot to finish these edges, but they're fine the way they are. Leave it.
Mm-hmm.
With Steven's theory of jank, someone was like, these jeans are perfect. Ship them. And then they get into the customer and the customer's like, what the heck is this in this pocket? Like, did they forget this?
Yeah.
It's hilarious. It's hilarious. Yeah. You know, like, so it wasn't intentional, but that there's still that same, there's still that idea of roughness.
Yeah.
Or even better, it's the player cannot suss out whether it was or wasn't intentional. And that that confusion might be pivotal.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like Ellen, in your analogy, it was like, what is this? Did they forget to sew this pocket together? Or did they do it on purpose? Like,
yeah.
You're never going to know. You could guess, right?
Yeah.
Maybe that's part of it.
Yes.
Okay.
yes. For sure. I think we're all in agreement, you know, as jank experts here in Nice Games Club. I think we're all in agreement that roughness is a core property of jank, right? Like,
yeah.
You can't just, like, it. There has to be some, and that roughness can materialize in any form, but it's gotta be a part of, like, the game design, I think. So, like, Lovers in a Dangerous Space-Time has that roughness in that, like, you know, two players can bump into one another and have a little bit of conflict. They'll be like, why are you in my way? But like, it never gets to it never is a detriment to the game. It also can feel like the pacing and I guess the feel of the game has that bumpiness to it that makes it feel good. I guess my argument is like, there has to be a little bit of unfinished property to the game in order for it to also feel janky. But I don't know that that's necessarily true. That is my instinct as that is my instinct, I guess, towards this. But I don't know that that's necessarily, I don't know that that's true. Like, I would agree that I think that Lovers in a Dangerous Space Time has a little jank. Maybe not as much as you two think, but I mean, there's some.
And importantly, not in the way that other people might describe it, because it's not an insult to that game, which is a very polished experience.
Exactly. No, yeah, that game's great. But yeah, I'm gonna have to do some more thinking, because if I'm ever gonna write this talk, I have to actively define what the heck this thing is.
I feel like, I mean, as we're closing out this episode, I do feel like we're getting closer to the shores of solid ground around jank as a concept.
Ellen's angling for you to rule in her favor. Like, wouldn't you say, Steven, wouldn't you say that Ellen was right?
I agreed with a lot of your points, Ellen.
Yeah.
I'm not ready to say you're completely right. I know you like being right, but...
I want to see that look of eureka on Steven's face and hear it in his voice.
What he discovered, he's like, oh my God, I figured it out. Ellen's right.
That would be nice.
I mean, we've all been there.
Yeah, it's true. It's very true.
And that's our show. Check out our website, nicegames.club, for show notes and links to resources on today's topics. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode and on our programming in general and on your theories about jank. Go to nicegames.club/feedback and tell us what you think. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter at Nice Games Club, where Dale tweets about game dev resources and tool recommendations by Holly Harrison. Or you can email us through contact@nicegames.club. Want to support the show? There are so many ways! Give us a review on your favorite podcast app, tell your friends about your favorite episodes, like this one, or join us on Discord by visiting nicegames.club/discord. And now we're on Patreon. As a patron of the show, you'll enjoy bonus content, extra jokes, and more. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub.
So until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.
We can end there. I don't have anything else to say, I guess.
We'll come back to jank. This is not the first time we'll talk about jank, I'm sure.
Jank part two, the jank in it. Yeah.
The jank.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.